Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabbit.
Good morning. Good morning. And here we are, fresh back from rainy England.
Yeah, but it looks like it's been raining here quite a lot, too, I'm afraid.
Yeah, but anyway, the one thing you can always do in rainy England is luxuriate in some wonderful country house properties and eat some absolutely delicious food. And, of course, and the menu is always in search of that. And we found it once again after a five-year gap at a wonderful place called Gidley Park. This program is going to be devoted to Gidley. And first of all, we're talking to General Manager Sue Williams about Gidley Park and also about a property that she happens to manage as well close by called the Bath Priory. So let's go to those interviews, and then we've got a fascinating surprise for you coming up later in the program. So stay tuned.
Sue Williams, General Manager of Gidley Park. You love this place, don't you?
I certainly do. It's a real passion of mine, yes. Consider myself very lucky, a lucky lady to be looking after such a beautiful property.
Right. Well, you have more than one, but we're going to be focusing today on Gidley Park, because that's where we are. And where exactly are we?
We're situated here on the edge of Dartmoor. So we're in the southwest of England, on the edge of this very beautiful national park, in a very rural location in the heart of Devon.
Down a very narrow, winding road.
Very narrow, challenging, mile and a half lane. Yes, a private road that brings you to the property. It's a real journey of discovery, and then at the end it all opens out into this beautiful plot, and you get a lovely view of the property for the first time.
Yes. Property itself is under new management. Well, not really new. Since last time we interviewed anybody from this property, it's under new ownership.
That is right, yes. That change of ownership took place in February of 2005. Paul and Kay Henderson have been the previous owners for 27 years and had done a tremendous job of building the reputation of this property, but had got to the point where I guess it was all getting very exhausting and wanted to sort of make a move. So really, all credit to them, they sought out purchasers who were people they really felt would love and care for the property and take it forward. And yes, a happy getting together of Andrew and Christina Brownsword, who are the current owners, who really are of the southwest and just fell in love with the property. They do obviously have a couple of other hotels, but they very much now see themselves as custodians of Gidley Park. And
it is. Everyone talks about it. Why is that? Nobody says, you know, they own. They say they just are custodians of, or they're just taken care of, or they're just...
Well, I like to think it's just a very gracious approach, I think. I think it's appropriate. It sits with the style of the house, that it just engenders this sort of feeling of fondness. And
the style is?
The house itself was actually built and completed in 1928.
Which I was amazed first time I heard, actually.
You think it's an older property, yes. But it is, yes. It's a sort of mock sort of Tudor, and it's sort of black and white sort of facade that it has. But it actually was there in 1928, which is the tail end of the arts and crafts movement, which reflects on the interiors. There's lots of lovely oak paneling, and it was just lovely for us when we decided it was time to refurbish, to take the detail of arts and crafts and take sort of lessons from that period and introduce it into the new interior.
Now, it was built as a private home?
It was, by an Australian gentleman, Mr. McIlwraith.
Oh, I forgot that.
Yes.
And then became a hotel?
First in 1977.
Okay.
And that's when Paul and Kay Henderson took it on, and it stayed in their ownership until 2005.
Right. And it's odd, because, I mean, they're American, or he is.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So now you started mentioning about the land. It's getting bigger even, too, isn't
it? That's right.
I have to say it's stunning. It has been pouring down rain, but it's still stunning. And the helicopter, people come here in helicopters? You have a helipad?
They do, yes. We're one of the very few properties in the southwest, hotels, that is, that has the opportunity to receive helicopters. I think other than that, you have to go to Exeter Airport. So, you know, we're lucky to have that facility. And it's just in balance. You know, it's great because we don't want to be a nuisance to our neighbours.
Yeah,
so they're not coming and going, buzzing in every day, but probably two or three helicopters per week. It's a lovely, such a stylish way to arrive at the hotel. From the air, the view must be just tremendous.
I said, let's take a picture of that and say that that's how we arrived, but yes. I guess not.
Which of course we did. You'll be able to see it on our website.
Yeah, because no, we're lying if we say we came in on it.
People, in order to know the truth, people will have to listen to the program.
Right. Now, back to the grounds, how would you sum up the setting? I mean, you've got some national, you're right in the middle of national
property. Yes, we're right on the edge of the national park itself. So the acreage that we have is now 107 acres in total, which is really made up of a mix of obviously lovely rolling meadows, a lot of forestry. We have the River Teen running through the grounds, which
is getting very swollen at
it
the
is
moment.
With the rain. It's a real joy to watch how it sort of changes over the days and weeks and the seasons, because it never dries. I mean, it's always got a very healthy flow, but certainly at times of heavy rain, the rush of water it swells very rapidly because it's coming off the moors, obviously at a great pace. So it just becomes really almost white water. You know, you can't quite raft on it, but it is. It's white water over beautiful boulders, and it's just beautiful to watch.
No, I mean, it's an exciting place on one hand, but it's also a quiet place. People tend to hang.
Exactly right. It's for people who do love the great outdoors and love the rural setting. It is true to say. It's a destination for people who love to walk, say, who love the great outdoors, just love the fresh air, all the flora and fauna. And it's what Gibby Park is all about.
Exactly.
Real R&R.
The land that you just acquired, you'll keep it in the state it's now in?
Yes, that's absolutely the intention. So previously we were 54 acres, and literally just this week we have now acquired a further 53 acres, which comprises of, well, more of the same, lovely meadowland. We've got a beautiful bluebell wood, which is just striking. It's to be viewed April, May time. Gosh, it's been managed over the years. It's just as far as the eye can see, a real dense carpet of bluebells, and just a lovely addition for our guests as an amenity walk to visit. We get a further stretch of river. For the diehards, you can swim in the river because we now have a portion that is deep enough for what we call wild swimming.
Cold,
but it is for
bit.
The diehards. You'd be, breath would be taken away because it's perishing cold, but it's just, again, it's a fun thing to do for the great lover of the outdoors.
Are you going to stock it with fish too?
It's already, there's river in there, there's trout in the river anyway, so that's something we don't have to take care of.
Mm. Now, let's get back to the renovations. I shouldn't even say this, but, well, I will say it actually. I thought that when we were here, I loved the graciousness of the place, but I thought it was a little run down at the heels, and I put that gently. So there was a lot of work to be done when the new owners took over.
There was.
And what did you do? Just run through.
Well, my goodness, the scope of works was tremendous. So I say we became owners in February of 2005, and we ran the hotel business as usual for the first 10 months to take that time to plan and to achieve planning permission, which is very difficult to achieve. And the national park are very much sticklers for obviously keeping control of what goes on, which is all good. And what we did was we took the hotel from 14 bedrooms to 24, and we did that by extending the house only by putting on a fourth gable, which balanced the house. Before it was a little out of kilter, so we balanced up the facade of the house and then also converted our loft. There was an oddity of this property that the loft was used to be occupied by the staff. There was a lot of staff living up in little cots up in the roof, but we built them additional accommodation elsewhere on the site, and we converted and created six beautiful loft rooms.
Now, so these rooms are all different, aren't they?
All completely different, yes.
Give us an idea of the kinds of rooms you might have here.
My goodness, well, we've kind of took the approach really on the first floor to keep the rooms a little more traditional. So we followed through with the arts and crafts sort of styling. So we had some paneling made and introduced that into a number of rooms, but have painted it lovely light and sort of, we think, elegant colours, and introduced sort of picture rails and things like that. So they're the large, comfortable rooms. We really did focus on the bathrooms.
Oh, the bathrooms, absolutely wonderful.
Well,
it's super,
yes,
super contemporary, even though it has some of the, you know, like the cloth.
We like to think comfortable, contemporary. We absolutely took comfort. It wasn't ever a case of style over substance. We really wanted to make sure that these were going to be very comfortable, very functioning, sumptuous bathrooms.
That touches my heart, because I said, I mean, after so many castles, I said, I love charm, but I'm really, really interested in plumbing.
I want a good shower. Yeah, so we've managed to achieve beautiful wet rooms in all bar one room, which was great. Our space obviously just curtailed us on one. But they're just really, we think, in line really with the thoughts of the traveller of today who, like you say, good bathrooms and sort of a little bit of romance and glamour is what's needed. So lovely sort of marble floors with underfloor heating, lovely big tubs, good water pressure, great showers.
Yeah. And you have Wi-Fi all over the place.
We do, yes, throughout the building. We were delighted, I have to say, because being as rural as we are, quite challenging.
I'm amazed.
But we achieved that. It's a huge requirement of today's traveller, so we totally get that. So, yes, we have it throughout.
We have so many amenities.
Yes.
I mean, there are all these little nooks and crannies to just curl up with a good book from, but then you also have flat screen TVs if you want them.
Yes.
You have incredibly trained staff and really wonderful staff.
Thank you. The team are just... I know it's obvious to say, but they are key. They really are. We're very lucky with the building and its location, but without a team whose heart and soul are in the delivery of lovely service and just general love and care of the building, it would not come together. But no, we work hard at the recruitment, and then they're in the training once they're with us, and we have a tremendous team.
You did bring a resident manager from a place that you knew, though.
Yes, our resident manager. Well, that's an interesting appointment. A fabulous lady called Susan Kendall, who was working with me at the Bath Priory Hotel. And her skill set, although it was tremendous, was really weighted to sort of front office and marketing side of things. But I started the whole process of recruiting for a general manager for the property. And these folks came along who were all in their sort of pinstripe suits and what have you. And it just was not a fit. It was not a fit. And I'm sure they're very skilled, experienced people. But I needed somebody who would take all the nuances of what was tremendous about the house before, acknowledge those, build those into the future of Gidley, but also obviously be sharp enough and a really good operator to take us forward into the 21st century. And Susan Kendall, I've said this before, we speak of it often. I could tell you the day I was talking to an agent, a recruitment agent in my office, and I was being a little fractious with them because they were sending me these candidates that were not a fit. And Susan Kendall walked into my office just on another matter. And when I put the phone down, she said to me, "If it was another year or two on, I'd throw my hat into the ring." And I took that thought and I discussed it with the owners, and I said that I would be very prepared to mentor Sue Kendall, and it's been absolutely the right tack to take for this property, because she's a fabulous candidate who has really taken the property to her heart and soul and does a tremendous job for us.
Now, when we came here before, Paul Henderson told us that we asked him what atmosphere, what he wanted the atmosphere to be, and he said, "I want it to be as if people are visiting me in my home," and that's exactly what it feels like.
Well, actually, as I said, we wanted to take all that was excellent about Gidley Park before and make sure none of that was lost, but just obviously refresh its interior and take it forward. And that it's a bigger property now. We need to have a few more systems and a little more, few more controls in place. But that was what was so special about Gidley before. And interestingly, while the project was going on and there was builders all over the property and there wasn't a single corner that wasn't ripped apart, and we had to create a very temporary office in our bar area and had a lady manning the phone throughout. And she's a lady called Helen who'd been looking after the hotel for so many years. And she was taking all these calls from the regulars saying, "I hope you're not changing it too much." And she looked around her and thought, gosh, only every stitch. And yet, you know, when a lot of the regular faces returned, best compliment of all was, "My goodness, what have you changed?" Because when you do walk into the reception area, the paneling and the sort of spatial layout was much the same. But of course, it's when you go a little further into the property and you get to visit the bedrooms, the lovely bathrooms, and obviously see the extension and the slightly enlarged dining room. You get to see what we were up to for 12 months with our project.
Now you have one very enormous asset that we haven't talked about, who's been with the property for a very long time, I think since about 1999.
That's right.
We're actually going to be talking to him later, but we're going to cheat. And we're going to ask you how you feel about the culinary continuity, shall we say.
Gosh. Just consider ourselves incredibly lucky that Michael Caine's has remained the common denominator at this property for such a long, long time now. Obviously, Michael working with Paul and Kay for such a long time was totally in the mode of what was Gidley before and could help us ensure that, you know, those high standards were maintained and evolved sort of going forward. Now, he is a tremendous asset to this property and a delight to talk to, as I know you'll find out later.
Yes, and he wins a lot of awards. We'll talk with him about that. But you are very proud of an award you've recently received. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, we're really delighted this year. We won Hotel of the Year with the Southwest Tourism Awards for Excellence.
How many people competed for that?
Well, it was a national award. First off, you have to put into the regional sort of contest, as it were, and do a written submission, and you get to be mystery shopped and what have you. So actually, as an entrant into the competition, you don't know whom you're up against and exactly how many are putting in. But we won the regional awards actually in November. We got a gold award, so November of 2008. And then as a regional winner, you're put through into the nationals. And those took place in April of 2009. And they have different categories, obviously, across the board. But there was small hotels and there was large hotels. But they decided that the standards were not where they kind of should be in some of the larger properties that were involved, and made it one. So it is, they amalgamated those two categories. So we are now to a Hotel of the Year 2009.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, you're also recognized by, is it Travel and Leisure or Condé Nast Traveler as well?
Yes.
So you're a high scoring property, and they don't have very many high scoring properties in this country.
That's right. Yes. That's also a placing we're delighting to have.
Now, you talked about guests typically staying for about a week.
Yes.
Which is quite unusual. You said, yes. I don't know what people do here for a week, but they all seem to have a wonderful time. But do you draw from overseas as well?
Oh, yes. A lot of overseas visitors. And I know it's all in the rates of exchange and the like, but certainly 2009 is seeing a real upturn of American visitors. And also from Europe, a lot of across the board, but from Germany, from France, Luxembourg predominantly, and from the Netherlands. They seem to be our sort of greatest number of visitors to date. But
kind of a demographic? A lot of times people want to know who they're going to run into when they're at a place like this in the country.
Gourmet travelers, I would say. People who, that sort of kindred spirit. People who have a love of fine food. But my goodness, people who love to tour, you know, they often have a group of two or three friends and a couple of lovely cars, and they sort of tour the area. But people also just want to use ourselves as a base for the Southwest. People who perhaps who are here longer, for perhaps a week, will use Gidley Park as a base and go off north and south, of course, and explore. They'll go to the coast, to Dartmouth and Salcombe, which are beautiful harbour towns. Just so much going on there, so much to see. There are a lot of other fine eateries in the Southwest, so sometimes they'll do a gourmet tour of the Southwest. Or people who just really love to walk, serious ramblers, you know, who want to get out onto the moors, because from the property you can leave your car behind and you can just get onto the moors within about 20 minutes. And, well, my goodness, we send people off with maps and make suggestions and send them off with picnics and rather sort of luxurious picnics for the day. And
listeners, you're looked after here, and make no doubt of that. And Sue, what about a website?
Certainly, our website is key and ever evolving. We're very mindful that it needs to be with some always new imagery and things like that. But it's up and running.
And it is
www.gidleypark.com.
Spelt
GIDLEIGH park.com.
Sue Williams, you're also the general manager of the Bath Priory. And now, we used to know it well. We haven't been, it's a absolutely charming property. We haven't been there since all the changes occurred, but it would be interesting if you could talk to our audience about some of the changes.
Yes, it's Bath Priory, also owned by the same family, Andrew and Christina Brownsword, and they've owned it now for 15 years, but it is ever evolving. It's a beautiful property, but the most sort of recent changes really were in March of this year, when we closed the property to re-equip our kitchen in readiness for a change of chef. And Michael Keynes, who is our two-star Michelin chef at Gidley Park, became the executive chef of the Bath Priory also, and put in a whole new team of chefs, and has really introduced his quality of food at the Bath Priory. So very exciting times for us, and the restaurant has seen a real upturn of business, so we're very busy and pleased to say, and obviously what can be an interesting and challenging trading year, but for us the restaurant's been really busy.
It's a really charming place to stay as well.
It is, yes. We have 31 bedrooms.
And this is the one where I kept getting lost in the hall, right?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. You could get lost in almost any hall.
It was initially a private house, and then it became a boys' school for a while, and it's been a hotel since 1969, but it has changed hands three times in that time. And Andrew and Christina Brownsword bought it 15 years ago and have just spent that time loving it and evolving it.
Oh, and it's a great showcase for her taste in art.
Yes, well, they both love art and collect art, and it really gives the public rooms at the Bath Priory some real sort of gravitas, because it is a fabulous collection. It is a very different feel to Gidley Park. I mean, it is like a country house hotel in the city. Mm-hmm. So you have the lovely sort of, you approach it and it is in a sort of a residential area. But once you're inside the property and you look beyond, it's got a very beautifully tended and established garden. Again, so different in its feel to Gidley, because it's all herbaceous borders, and we have a fabulous gardener, Jane Moore, who's a silver winner at Chelsea.
Yes.
We met her when we were there.
Right? That's right. Well, Jane's been there nearly 6 years now.
Right.
So
yeah.
That would be right, yes.
And of course, you have a garden here at Gidley too. Do we talk about that?
Well, it is. It's all part and parcel of our acreage. There's less so in terms of detail. There are a few herbaceous borders here at Gidley. We have a fabulous vegetable garden.
That's
which
what
is
I was talking about.
Very beautiful and a tremendous asset. What is produced there obviously does make its way into the kitchen, and it produces a great deal. It was newly formed in 2007. We brought in 400 tons of granite to create some beautiful granite walls, semicircular terraced wall, then vegetable beds. So, my goodness, it's only its second year season, if you like, for producing for us, but it's really coming on in leaps and bounds. That's lovely.
But to close up on the Bath Priory, one of the things I thought that was really nice about it is that Bath's a beautiful city. Knockout beautiful architectural masterpiece. You almost OD, you almost overdose on Regency architecture. One of its huge downsides is that it's very difficult to navigate in a vehicle.
Yes.
So not having to have a vehicle and having a beautiful walk through the park to get to the city, I think to me is one of the greatest attractions that Bath Priory has. And let's just conclude with the website for Bath Priory.
It's www.thebathpriory.co.uk.
And there's another thing that we shouldn't forget about the Bath Priory upcoming, Sue.
That's right, yes. We have just refurbished our spa. So we have had a spa since 97, but it was time to refresh it from top to toe. So we closed it in February of this year, and we have ripped it out and taken it all the way back to the bare bones, and reformed the spaces, and it's really looking tremendous, and we obviously have extended it, taken the opportunity to extend it. So that will be opening on the 17th of September 2009, and we will have a beautiful pool, elliptical steam room, saunas, treatment rooms, and a gym.
I can assure you we're
yes,
here.
Yes, lovely asset for the house.
And listeners, it's just as lovely as it sounds at both Gidley Park and Bath Priory, so we hope you'll take advantage of the opportunity to go there just as soon as you can. And now it's time to
take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu. And remember to stay in touch with us. Just go to our website and just click on one of those buttons. You can email us. You can follow the podcast. You can Twitter along or look us up on Facebook.
How about that?
How about that?
We have it all covered, and we had it all covered in Gidley Park as well, because one of the immense attractions, and we already talked with Sue about that, is a chef who's been practicing his art there since 1999 and was just about to celebrate the 10th year of holding two Michelin stars. A really remarkable chef and a remarkable young man called Michael Caines.
One of the great keys to the success of Gidley Park is, of course, their chef, and he's going to explain how many other places he influences. But he himself, I think, has been influenced by these great properties that he's been involved with. What do you say, Michael Caines? We love you.
Well, that's very kind. Well, yes, I think I've been captivated by places I work in, but indeed, not only where I'm working now, but the places I worked before. And that has all contributed into my own philosophy on food and how I want people to enjoy my food. And Gidley Park really is perfect for me. It's in my home county, the southwest, Devon. And it's a country house hotel with wonderful farming pastures right around us by the sea. Well, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes. We've got wonderful seafood, a great larder here in Devon, cheeses,
sure,
butter,
yeah,
cream, and of course, wonderful beef, pork, lamb, poultry. We're just blessed. I've said often or not that I believe the Southwest has the best larder in Europe. So
I agree.
I'm very lucky.
Now, how long have you been chefing?
Well, I'm now 40, so I started. Yeah, I know. Help. But I started my catering career at college when I was 16. And okay, left at 18. So professionally, I've been cooking for 22 years now, and of which I've been 15 years at Gidley Park. And this year I celebrated keeping my second star for 10 years. So I think that's a fairly good, a good 22 years, really.
Now, you've really worked at a number of other places as well that were important. I'm thinking of your French connections.
Yeah, very much so. There was Bernard Oiseau, the late Bernard Oiseau in Saulieu. Of course, when I went to France and Robuchon. And prior to going to France, I worked for Raymond Blanc at the Manoir 4 Saisons. So those three chefs.
Everybody, I think, is a decent chef, and I mean, an expired chef worked for Raymond.
Well, he is an inspiration, and also he himself has inspired many, many, many chefs.
Now, didn't you go to that special reunion that he had of all the chefs who had been through his kitchen?
I did, indeed. That was really good fun. And, of course, this year they have the 25th anniversary of the Manoir 4 Saisons, so I'm looking forward to being invited back to that as well. But it was a great reunion for his wonderful birthday. And, of course, it's only then when you realize how many people have been inspired by his passion for food.
We're talking now just from Gidley Park. Tell us just how many other, I don't even know how to describe it, how many other menus and food programs and wine programs are you involved with? Mm. You're a partner in
business, yeah. Since we spoke, we have expanded our hotels. We created a hotel company called Abode Hotels, which is home to Michael Caine's restaurants.
And that's A-B capital.
It is. That's right.
Because of Andrew
Brownsword, correct, yeah. And Andrew is a fantastic man. We met back in 2003, should I say.
Oh, where? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and we bought a hotel together at the Royal Clarence where I had a restaurant. We bought the hotel and we created we co-founded and created Abode Hotels, which we rolled out into four properties. So that's Exeter, Glasgow, Manchester and Canterbury. Next year we have Chester, and then 2011 we are set to open in in Salisbury. And
it's still going great guns.
Absolutely. I have been very, very busy with that. That's been a real tough but really enjoyable time of my life for these past few years. But also this year, I took on the responsibility of executive chef of overseeing and developing the menus and the restaurant at the Bath Priory Hotel, which is our sister hotel to Gidley Park. And actually, it was Andrew and Christina's first hotel that they bought back in the 90s and renovated and restored, and that very much is actually where Andrew and Christina used to court, if you like, and they bought the hotel allegedly because they didn't want to see it be ruined by somebody. So
they were courting that.
They were, and they fell in love with the Bath Priory, and eventually they owned it. So
and then they fell in love with each other.
Yeah, and
or
you know.
Vice versa, yeah.
So it's great, and it's a wonderful property. And Sue, as you know, Williams, who's already spoken to you with
she's
the guards.
Fabulous.
Yeah, she looks after those two properties and makes sure. What we want to do is Sue and I both share the same vision, and what Andrew and Christina want to achieve, if you like, is a synergy of quality, but an individual experience within the houses themselves. And all the traits of quality in the food and beverage and service is about the quality of delivery and making sure that our guests get the most excellent of service and wonderful food creations. And I make sure that also that we don't replicate the same dishes on the menus here.
Well, how do you do this? I mean, you find chefs then that you're going to give them a sort of a template for what you want to do, and then they just implement their own inspiration?
Well, it's a bit of a mix. I have, after, you can imagine, 15 years at Gidley Park, many signature dishes. I have extensive repertoire. The sous chef of Gidley Park is now the head chef of Bath Priory. So I have a recipe database, and you know, I created dishes, and we tweaked a few, and Jane's had a few ideas as well that we developed especially for Bath. It works well.
Now, I think you told us the last time we were here that you were going to use Gidley Park as a training ground for the chefs who are going to go to all the abode
hotels.
Yeah,
I remember that too.
Is that still the program?
It very much is. And as I said, James has gone to Bath. In abode hotels, we have Tom in Exeter, Hawks Williams, who's a wonderful chef, with my sous chef here as well. We have Ian Mafton, who worked with me 7 years here at Gidley Park, and in all has worked with me for 10 years in total. He's the head chef at the wonderful restaurant and hotel we have in Manchester. And we have a guy called Mark Rossi that's...
We should have known this about Manchester. We didn't know where to go to eat.
Wow. Well, now you know.
Well, we ate at the Marriott Hotel. It wasn't all that bad.
Good. But and then, of course, we have Mark Rossi at Canterbury, who's also Gidley. And in Craig, we have a new chef who's, if you like, came outside of the fold, but he nevertheless spent a significant time here at Gidley prior to taking his position, and we work on the menus together. Really, I suppose it's important that my philosophy and my recipes for sauces and some of the fundamentals, building blocks, if you like, of the kitchen, observed. But I think it's important that we allow our chefs as well to be creative and have a creative input, because they all have individual ideas which can be crafted, which can create a unique experience within itself.
Now, I mean, what do you view as your... There is a... something that carries over is your style, all these recipes, but they're all very different. I mean, what do you think it is about you, your style? And secondly, I mean, like, why do these people just absolutely adore you and they feel so inspired?
Well, perhaps it's easy to explain the first one more so than the second part of the question, in the sense that I believe my philosophy of food is based in great technique, in real classical foundation. I believe that you can't know where you're going with food creativity unless you know where you're from. So I really do believe that we should look first to that, if you like, that wonderful history of and knowledge that's entrenched within the classic cuisine or the classical cuisines of the world. I mean, you can take inspiration from Italian foods and Spanish, of course, as well as Indian and Asian foods. I think what we have to realize is that food has been a part of our culture for thousands of years, and as we develop and as we become more sophisticated and we travel more, our tastes widen and broaden, our opinions of foods are broadened as well as we travel. And I think what's wonderful is that you must keep your food relevant, and I just like to allow things to be as natural and as well presented as possible, but extracting out all the wonderful flavours by using some great techniques and also by being inspired myself as a foodie by all the food styles that are out there.
So you think basically that the French technique still drives quality, and whatever the different cuisine is, it still drives quality.
I do believe it. I do. I think it, what it does is that it focuses a discipline. You can, it gives you an extra refinement in your process of thinking. Brasserie style food is very different, perhaps, than fine dining, it's fair to say. And if you look at Italian food, it's very, you know, it is almost very simple foods, but done well. What French cuisine does, what haute cuisine does, like haute couture, is it really does refined cuisine to a real high degree of execution, and in not just, of course, in food itself, but also in food service and wine service. So for me, if you were going to, if you were saying to somebody, I'd love to buy a haute couture garment in fashion, people are spending money on something absolutely fabulous, which is really iconic and very precious. For me, I think when you're talking about fine dining, it has to have some of that haute couture. Haute cuisine, as we refer to it in France, really is the pinnacle of our industry. And from that, we can draw down and inspire different food types.
But how do you explain then the supremacy currently of Spanish cuisine as opposed to French? And I mean, I just read a book concerning the decline of the French cuisine standards, and I said,
well, I don't necessarily agree that Spanish cuisine has taken a bigger influence over the world. I think what we must remember in French cuisine is that it borders many countries, and that French cuisine itself is very provincial in its cooking, and if you look at the cuisine that's done in the south, it's very different to what you would get in Alsace or northern France,
yeah, sure,
or for that matter from the Pyrenees. Spanish cuisine actually has not as much regional identity as Italy or Spain, but right now there's some amazing Spanish chefs that have been inspired, the likes of El Bulli, Fernando, and what he's doing. But it's a very small proportion in terms of what's being achieved across the globe. And I think you have to put it in context. I think when you're talking about innovation and food styles, yes, sure, there's a lot of stuff that's come out of Spain that's been inspiring. But any more so than what's come out of Japan and some of the inspiring cuisines that have been influenced from that, or any less perhaps from Italian foods, which has been inspiring French cookery.
Have you cooked in Japan?
No, I haven't cooked in Japan, but I love the Japanese style of cooking. It's wonderful. And of course, for modern times, it's quite a light and healthy way of eating. And its popularity has grown very much in England and in UK over the last 10 years. I think with food trends, things come in and out. The problem with French cuisine is it's very much been there as the benchmark for many years. And in a way, food and the culture in France, as the wine culture in France, has taken a real beating from New World wines in with the up
the wine situation,
absolutely,
really
with the
bad,
with the upping and coming of those wonderful wines, but also also from new styles of cuisine, and also the fact that we're in an era where we've had 15 years of growth, of wealth and of development, and a lot of people have more and more disposable income to go out. And food, dining, if you like, it's not seen as an elite sport. So the French are having to reinvent themselves. But I think, you know, I mentioned one man, if you want to talk about benchmark or quality cuisine, one man, for me, speaks volumes, and that is Joël Robuchon. What he's achieved across the globe.
He worked with him,
is incredible, right? Yeah. Joël has now 18 Michelin stars and is considered the world's most prolific chef. I mean, he's French. It's amazing.
He's French. He's still relevant, but he deviates a little from traditional.
He's a good example of what he's done to modernize French.
Isn't it amazing that he quit?
I know.
He retired and said he wouldn't do it anymore.
He just jumped right back there.
And then he jumped right back and opened this Atelier de Joël Robuchon in Paris.
Yeah.
We were among the first probably 2,000 customers.
Wow.
When we went there, and he's taken on the world now with Atelier de Joël Robuchon everywhere.
But wouldn't you agree that for a man to come back with a concept so unlike the restaurant he closed,
oh sure,
was really quite inspirational.
Well,
what it did is
totally
redefined
dramatic.
The way that people perhaps want to dine with fine dining. It takes away all the pomp and ceremony and gives people really what they want, quality in food and service, of course, is still there, but it's done in a less pretentious way, and it's done in a way where everybody can feel a part and comfortable of it.
All these young chefs rave about you. Yes. I mean, what do you give them? You still have your own style.
Well, this comes to that one thing I was going to say as well, because I think you can probably answer them at the same time, because they talk about here an OBE is other bloke's efforts.
Yeah, yeah.
But you only got a member of the Order of the British Empire. But I think it says something about the contributions that you've made to the business you're in.
I think, yeah, I think it refers to my bloody effort. I think it's what they. But no, your questions are taken on board very much in a humble way. It's great that so many young chefs and chefs out there look up and look to me as an inspiration. I've not had an easy ride. I have overcome difficult times to continue to develop and to pursue my passion in life, which is food. My gift is that I can bring to people my ability to cook and please so many people. And my story is inspirational. My drive is inspirational. And I'm living my life. I'm living my life to the full. And I'm living my dream of wanting to be one of the top chefs in the country. And if people out there admire what I do and I'm an example to others, then that's fantastic. You know, I really do draw inspiration from that. But I'd rather be criticized for trying than to criticize and do nothing. And as long as I continue to have the ability to develop and to inspire, continue to work in that way. And it's lovely to hear that people are inspired by my story and by what I do. And
well, there are people that are people, and then there are people who are... You seem to be able to have your own identity, but also allow other people, your juniors, perhaps, to have their own identity.
Yeah, it's a difficult balance to make, because I can talk about myself as a third person, as a business and a brand, but at the same time, you do realize that people are your business, and their contributions to the business are equally important. And working for Raymond Blanc is a good example of how, through the years, you can inspire and develop the respect and admiration of others. But also, what I realize, that if you give those people the opportunity to work for you, with you, they can also achieve and develop, and in turn, you develop too.
Now, the next item on the agenda is a presentation. We have a presentation of a new cookbook.
Wow.
From a friend of yours. It's sitting in front of you. And you
I've noticed and it. You didn't, Percy's cookbook.
You didn't notice. Cause
I've clocked it already.
Well, because we came from Percy's last evening.
Wow.
And
Tina.
Tina and Tony Bricknell-Webb.
Yes.
Wanted us to give you your own autographed copy. So you have a pre-release autographed copy.
That is wonderful.
I don't know what it says, but I think it says something pretty nice in the front.
Let's have a look.
Let's see what it says.
To Michael, with lots of love, very best wishes, Tina and Tony.
I loved you. That's the other thing. You're maybe too nice. There you go. I oftentimes think that there's probably some dark side of you that I've never known.
No, we actually heard this little secret from Tony and Tina, that when you were trying to get away from it all and wanted to go somewhere to eat, Percy's is a place you go to quite often.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful place. And I love Tina's style of cooking. I love the fact that...
It's so honest, isn't it?
It is. It's very, very honest. Not only is it honest, but it's also true to their location, with their aspirations that they want, the lifestyle that they want to live. And both of them have worked very, very hard. And Tina, also being a female chef, is an inspiration to a lot of people out there. And it's not an easy location where they are, and to make
it
work...
It's in the middle of nowhere.
I know. And to make it work, you know, you have to take your hat off to him. And I do enjoy going to Percy's, and I have done many, many years now, and I always recommend it. Whenever people say, where is there to go in the Southwest, Percy's is always on my to-do list and of places to go.
Well, now, you said the other wonderful thing was that when I was talking to you before, you said not only recounting what you've already done, and you've done a lot and it keeps expanding, but also you wanted to indicate what's down the path, what you're going to be doing. Do you have any hint to give us about that?
Yes, I mean, it's great. You know, here we are with six properties, if you like, seven in total that are in our group, if you include our baby abode in London, six of which I have influence with regards to the restaurants and the food and beverage. And, of course, we'll be expanding our abode group with Michael Caine's restaurants very much at the heart of that concept, into Chester next year in 2010, launching in March. And then beyond that
should be a great place to be.
Absolutely wonderful. We've got a fifth floor restaurant and champagne bar, which overlooks the race course in the city. We have an MC bar, cafe bar and grill, and a bar MC for just as a place to go and drink. We've got a wonderful concept, which we think will work for Chester. And of course, looking beyond that in 2011, we also have our new venture, our hotel in Salisbury, which is going to be a wonderful addition to our portfolio. And Salisbury itself is a beautiful city, which in a way lacks a little bit of what we're going to bring. So
I did Salisbury.
I think we've chosen another wonderful location, and again, it's a fitting city for the type of hotels and the type of restaurants that we create, where we can also focus on local, regional, foods, and at the same time.
Michael, how does anybody keep up with you? I mean, do you post this on your website or what?
I do. We have a newsletter. We have a case correspondent. We do keep track of all the development through our website and also through.
Could you give us the information?
Absolutely. For the website is michaelcaines.com. Very easy. Okay. And on there you'll find.
Let's just quickly add that that's C-A-I-N-E-S.
That's right. And if you type in Kane,
not to be confused with the wonderful actor.
That's right. Well, maybe one day they'll confuse him with me.
And how do you get the newsletter?
Well, the newsletter, we used to print them. Oh, and yeah. And now what we're doing is all of the Kane's correspondence archived are on the website. And we'll be looking to go to an email version into 2010, so that we'll be able to email, and we our database out. There's about 40,000 currently email addresses that we email to, and that's increasing all the time. And we have newsletters and that we send out as well to inform people what's going on. So we're quite proactive with that.
What do you do in your spare time?
Well, I try and relax with the children, and if I can get a day off cooking and be cooked for, then I'll take that as a wonderful relaxing. But I'm into a little bit of sport, been running, cross country, trail
You're
running.
A runner, huh?
Well, I am, or have been of lately. I the last year now, I've enjoyed running across the hills and cross country across Dartmoor, which is literally here. And on my doorstep where I live, but also it's just nice to get out and do some walking. I went to Peru last year in the
Oh, you did, because we're going in January. I need to know all about that.
Well, I had a fantastic trip to Machu Picchu, the foothills of Machu Picchu,
right,
to Santa Maria, which is where the Joaquim Cooperative for Joaquina, should I say, cooperative, which is the people there create Organica, or shall we say Arabica organic bean, which we get through Cafe Direct, which is a fair trade product, which is the coffee that we use in our restaurants. And I went to meet the growers and to see that the premiums from the coffee was being used to support and to develop the community, which it was.
It was a 10-day
lifetime trip. I was completely inspired by its landscape and by the fact that these people in the middle of nowhere were growing, cultivating and drying these beans that were being imported and roasted and eventually found their way into our cup. And we serve it with great pride in knowing that also that premiums from the coffee sales are going back to the communities within Peru and helping families develop their lives, which is fantastic.
You are ever surprised. I just never know where you're going to go next.
We will bring a postscript report on dinner.
Great.
Which curiously,
yeah, we're
going to
eat,
actually. Because if we don't let Michael go, there won't be any dinner for us and for some other people who are also looking forward. Michael, thank you so much once again. It's a delight to see you, and we're so glad that we were able to get you back on the menu.
Thank you both. It's been a pleasure.
Now, I know just Anne wants to talk to you about just a couple of items off the absolutely delicious menus that we sampled.
Yeah, no, I mean, mind you, not only give other just two of us in tasting menus, but we each got something different for every single course, which is a real coup for the kitchen. I just want you to have an idea of the kinds of food that we had in this tasting menu. For example, langoustine cannelloni with braised fennel and two sauces, a vierge and a shellfish, river dart wild salmon, so that's a local product right there, couldn't have been fresher, with a citric caviar, salmon, jelly, and cucumber, honey, soy, and wasabi, and Greek yogurt vinaigrettes. Then we had, oh, I love this. Of course, Peter liked the pan-fried foie gras with orange braised chicory, caramelized walnuts, and marinated raisins in an orange sauce. But I loved this Brixham, which is, again, local, Brixham turbo and scallops with crisp belly pork, pea puree, and a shallot and smoked bacon velouté. Not to mention the farm rosé veal, selection of fabulous British cheeses. That was just from one menu, one of us. The other one starts with a tartare of marinated tuna, scallops and lime with a cetra caviar, sauce, turnip, and beetroot, wasabi, cream, honey, and soy vinaigrette. The kitchen likes that combination. How about lobster fricassee with baby vegetables and herbs? Oh, I love this too, the Cornish duckling, honey and spices, and an apple galette. And, of course, again, local Dartmoor lamb, yum, with fondant potato, vegetable niçoise, and tapenade jus.
You just can't stop this lady.
No, I can't. I'm stopping now because I'm getting hungry all over again.
She's drooling, and stay with us because after the break, we have a special treat in store for you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are back again. And I've been promising you a special treat. Oh, maybe Mrs. Rabbit can't get a word in edgeways here. Go ahead. You know what's coming next.
Right. We're going to revisit our initial interview from 2005 with Michael Caines.
So you'll find how much of Michael is still the same and how much his work has developed in the intervening years, and I think you'll really find it fascinating.
Yeah, a section of England which my husband describes as down a dark road in Dartmoor at a very special place called Gidley Park, and with a very special chef who is Michael Caines, who is celebrating his 10th year at this restaurant. I want to introduce him and have him tell us a little bit about how he got started, his interest got started in food, and about the kind of foods he's doing here. Hello, Michael.
Hello, how are you? Well, it's lovely to have you here in the UK. For me, food always has been a passion in my life, very much started from my family background, and helping mum in the kitchen. And from there, the interest grew into a career, and I grew up in Devon, so I went to catering college in Exeter, then off to London, where I did a year and a half in the big Grosvenor House. And then it was here that I actually met Raymond Blanc and decided that he was a very inspiring man. I spent 3 years at the Quatre Saisons in Oxfordshire, two-star Michelin. And it was also a Relais and Chateau, so it's a wonderful hotel, a beautiful setting. And it was Raymond himself that suggested after 3 years at the Quatre Saisons that I should go to France. And I obliged, and I went to France for 2.5 years. I spent a year with Robuchon in Paris and a year with Bernard Oiseau, both three-star Michelin. And I had a little bit of time to kill before I came back to take up my post here at Gidley. So I went and learned how to make the bread in a bakery. I worked in some brasseries and just basically immersed myself within the French culture in those 2.5 years, which was fantastic.
Now, he is eloquent, Michael is, and he has embarked on an effort to make fine food more accessible. Before that, I want to quote you, Michael. When you say three-star cooking isn't any harder than two-star, but it's more consistent, simpler, more pure, certainly the closest you'll get to the true flavor of the ingredients. I say amen.
Thank you very much. It's a quote from when I began my sort of cooking as a head chef, and I think it's important that we listen to quotes that we're instinctive about, and I still believe that's the case now. It doesn't have to be complicated; it just has to be good, and it has to be consistent. Because to be without that consistency, you know, you undermine the customer's ability to come back and experience that dish. And you can have one or two dishes which can stay the same, but they evolve.
and the basic flavours will always be good combinations, and great ingredients cooked simply. I know when we say cooked simply, it doesn't always seem that it's simple, but sometimes the most complicated dishes can be simply executed, and I think really for the essence of cooking food is in not making it too complicated and making it as enjoyable as we can for the customer.
Now, you are here, but you are also other places and intend to be even more places. Could you explain to us the other restaurants that you're developing and particularly your concept of accessible food, but mentioning that you train all of your staff out of this kitchen in Gidley Park?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very important point that in the mainstream here in the UK, not everybody sees food in the same way as you would perhaps take, for instance, our colleagues in France, Italy and Spain. You know, it's part of their culture that everybody has a right to eat well. In the UK, we still don't have that, and there's this huge, great big gap within the middle sector of the market where everyday people aren't able to be accessible to good food. And, you know, I always remember the stories in France of the truckers stopping at lunchtime to the routier and having a fantastic menu. And it was kind of like, you know, 10 or 15 francs. And it wasn't a lot of money. And they'd have a, you know, local wine, a glass of water, and they'd have a really good meal. We don't have that equivalent. And I really want to do something more than just cooking at the top end of the industry. So 5 years ago, we set up Mike Fang's Restaurants, and we took over the running of the food and beverage of a hotel in Exeter, which is only half an hour, which is my hometown. And last year, I bought that with my business partner, Andrew Brownsword. And what we do is, you know, 10 years on now, here at Gidley Park, you can imagine the sort of the depth of talent that we've accumulated within our cuisine here, or our kitchen here, and people who have gone on, have come back, and have gone on, developed themselves elsewhere. And now they're looking for a platform for themselves to mature into becoming a chef. And you know, that's part of the concept too, is giving these people a platform, the future generation, a platform to cook on. And, you know, we've bought the Clarence, and we have a fine dining restaurant there. We also have a restaurant at the Bristol Marriott, which is a wonderful building, a superb restaurant. And with my business partner, Andrew, we're set to acquire more hotels with our new abode concept, which will always have a Michael Caine's restaurant within. But not just fine dining, but also a cafe bar. We have a boutique for takeaway sandwiches, gourmet sandwiches. And we even have a pub, which we call Tavern, which is much more simpler food. So we believe that our concept should be inclusive, not exclusive.
Can you reference some of the cities, Michael, that you expect to be in addition to Exeter?
Yeah, we've kind of highlighted 15 to 20 cities, and they're spa towns like Cheltenham, places, I mean, cities are very obvious, like Manchester, London, Birmingham, Canterbury, Gloucester, Cheltenham, Oxford. You know, major cities and towns. We've already got the Art House in Glasgow, looking for a hotel in Edinburgh. So we are looking at all the major cities, key cities and towns over the UK.
I didn't know you were going to tackle London too. Well, you have so many ideas, interesting ideas. I was fascinated with your explaining how this area in southwest England is the best larder in England. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, we're very fortunate here in the southwest to have the southernmost part of England. So therefore we have early summers, or should we say early springs and late summers. And our climate is such that we have a better growing season perhaps than, say, Scotland. The other thing that's quite characteristic about the southwest is that we have these roaming pastures, which don't lend themselves to large agriculture sort of farming. So we tend to have a lot of pork, sheep, and of course cows that are grazing, and we have a very good meat industry here. Some fantastic indigenous breeds like the South Devons and North Devons. That also lends itself well to great cheese production, and of course we're an island, and we have some of the warmest waters around the south coast here, and we have absolute abundance of fish here in the channel and around the south coast. So lobsters, scallops, sea bass, John Dory, and a wonderful mix of different shellfish and seafoods, and fantastic.
Well, he's fascinating, isn't he?
He's a man on a mission.
Yeah,
it's good to see.
And what do you think of the mission?
It's I hope he achieves it. That's all I can say for him to talk about the French truck drivers and what they have available to them and to try and achieve to do something like that in England. I wish him all the best of luck. That's a long way to go on something like that.
This is a young man who overcame a number of obstacles through his life already. So I have the sneaking feeling that he has the stuff to make it all happen.
And if he has the support with the people around him, why not?
His partner Andrew apparently had a successful greeting card company which he sold to Hallmark.
Yeah.
So he's in a position where he's able to make the investments required to pull this kind of thing off without having to ask too many people questions.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably going to be part of the secret to his success. It's interesting. The people we interviewed last week, we talked to almost exclusively after we had eaten. In the case of Juniper, it was after dinner. In the case of the other two, it was actually the next day. So it gave us an opportunity to reflect on what we had eaten as well. And we were able to do things, a little more leisurely fashion. We actually talked to Michael before we ate.
Well, talked to him twice.
So we had a long chat with him before we did this interview and talked about where he was going. And then he speaks about some other aspects of his life and his attitude in other interviews that are upcoming on the other side of the break.
Welcome back to On the Menu. Remember that you can email us at any time. The address is onthemenu@edge1550.com. And we're going to resume our recorded interview with Chef Michael Caines of Gidley Park and many other places in England. We're back talking to Michael Caines at Gidley Park. And I wanted to ask you have 2 stars. Are you after the 3rd Michelin star?
Most definitely. The 3rd is a very important factor. I mean, if you don't drive for that 3rd star, you've got nothing to improve yourself by or to. And I think for me, it's the culinary goal that is left to achieve. And I think it's very much something that is a personal goal for myself that I've set myself.
Do you write cookbooks? Do you have a television show? Are you interested in being a celebrity?
I didn't come into the industry to become a celebrity. I came here because I have a passion to cook. But I'd love to write a book. I'd love to document my thoughts, my philosophy on food, if you like. And that's something very much that perhaps we can start in 2005. TV-wise, well, some people say they'd like to be a star in the kitchen rather than on the TV. But I sense that there'll be an opportunity in the future. But providing it's educational and it's based on my thoughts and feelings of food, then I think that would be something I can immerse myself and could be passionate about. But I wouldn't want to do TV just for the sake of doing it, to be recognized. I'm not in it for that.
Now, I'm going to throw one at you. You did study with Bernard Loiseau. What a shocker.
What a tragedy, absolutely. I mean, the man was, unfortunately, perhaps lost his perspective of life. And, you know, Bernard was a wonderful man, 55 years old, and unfortunately took his life. And, you know, people have said it's because of a hint that he would lose his reputation as a 3-star Michelin chef. Well, that wasn't the case. They still have 3-star, and rightly so. I think, you know, he put everything into his work, and perhaps in doing so he lost his perspective. But the Relais Bernard Loiseau, as it's now called, it used to be called the La Côte d'Or, you know, lives on in the spirit of Bernard, and he's a fantastic man. He's a very charismatic man. And, you know, that's a tragedy, really, of somebody perhaps who became too immersed within the celebrityism of being a chef. So, such a tragedy.
You said you also, although you are a regional cook, I mean, you're French trained, that you all, and you don't believe in mad experimentations, that good food is flavor. Do you absorb, though, you said, different influences. You're interested in Asian cooking.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my mind for food is like a sponge. I just love to taste and to experiment with food, but I also like to understand a culture. So, you know, it's lovely to have the opportunity in my job to eat out and to experience other cultures.
Well, we're going to experience your food this evening, and we will pick up this interview tomorrow morning and talk about the food that you serve us up tonight. Thanks till tomorrow, Michael.
I mean, isn't he an impressive human being?
He's a sensible man.
Yeah.
He has, you know, he has everything going in the right direction. He knows what he's talking about. He's focused. He's serious about what he does. And he's not an egotistical chef.
No.
He's thinking about, and it's great to hear, you know, the people we listened to last week were all about their own restaurant.
Right.
And all about, not wanting to sound negative, but all about themselves and their development within that restaurant.
And that's
fine.
Too.
And that was all absolute chef talk.
Yeah.
This is a gentleman who has achieved that. He's very successful. He's very well known. And he wants more. He wants to actually give something to people other than himself. And that has to be applauded. It's great to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, he paid his dues. He said, if you remember, we talked to him a little bit longer about Bernard Loiseau. So we weren't really throwing the question in.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if our listeners know, this is the chef who got a demotion from Gault Millau,
yeah.
And he anticipated that he would lose a star. And, I mean, the debate is still out. He also supposedly was a manic depressive bipolar disorder.
So they say.
So we don't know.
I don't think it's really that important, the hows and the whys. It's a terrible loss for the industry.
Yeah, exactly.
He was a great, great man. And we should just appreciate him for what he did. And
eaten the food?
No, I've driven by the place a couple of times. He's actually not too far from where my parents have a house. Never got the opportunity to eat there.
The measure of Michael is that he said he went to the funeral.
Anne says a lot.
Anne said she thought it was a shame that they didn't close the restaurant on the day of the funeral. And he said, but they didn't close it on the day of the funeral because people were already on the way to go there.
Yep.
So they kept it open that night.
Sure,
it's
a very tough time for them.
And then they closed for a week. But now they're back with the renamed restaurant and his wife is running it very well. So, but I did think it was a real tribute to his appreciation for someone from whom he learned a lot.
Yeah, I think that touched everybody.
That he would take the time to go. Also an interesting connection to Raymond Blanc.
Yeah.
Who was very much the godfather, I guess, of French cooking in England.
Yeah, absolutely.
And some of our other chefs have spoken about him. He was an interesting character, listeners. You might or might not remember, who hosted an entire event of American chefs cooking.
Oh, right.
In England.
Yeah.
Cooking their typical menus. Thomas Keller and people of that went over. Patrick O'Connell went over there.
All the top chefs, basically, from the country.
Yeah, Raymond Blanc sponsored the whole thing. It was his idea. So this is an intriguing guy. This is a place we have to go one of these days. My French isn't good enough.
La Manoir, quatre saisons.
There you go. Well done.
There
well
you
done, Danny.
My best French.
I was going to say the manner of the four seasons in my native English.
There you
but
go.
It works just
what a compliment.
Works just as well either way. So we had a fascinating time. This is, by the way, listeners, just in case you're tuning in and wondering what's going on, this is on the menu. This is not this is not a new program on H1550 called the Michael Caine Show. and Michael and Hamilton and Paul and Kay, we do hope you have the opportunity to be listening to us also. And we're going to hear some more a little bit later on.
I wanted to ask Danny did I introduce you?
I think you may have gone way back like 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, well, we did that last week.
You were going to be off air. You were telling me about your parents moving to France. Where do they live?
They Burgundy. Live in the middle of Burgundy. They're actually, if anybody knows Beaune, which is basically
right.
sort of northern Burgundy, it's about 20 miles south of there. They've lived there. They've lived on and off for about 25 years now.
Well, did they flee the weather, the climate?
The climate, the people, the depressing food. I mean, this was, you know, 25 years ago. It wasn't what it is today. Maybe if the food were as good as it is now back then, maybe they'd still be living in England.
Did your father retire and do this, or did he actually?
They did retire, but they still have a business running there. They have guest houses.
Oh, do they really?
They do, yeah.
Why don't you give them a plug?
I would love to. I'm not sure whether advertising now online, but the place is called En La Mar. That's the name of the little area they're in. And I couldn't tell you whether advertising fraud or where to find a link for that.
How do you spell it?
Enlamare.
So, and it's a good state.
It's a beautiful spot in the middle of the vineyards in Burgundy.
Oh, wonderful.
We were planning to go to Burgundy sometime.
Maybe you should think about that. Absolutely.
You were married there, too.
Yes, we got married there 6.5 years ago. And my sister got married there at Christmas last year.
Oh, that's right. You were there
Christmas.
So
we were back there.
Year.
She got married in the same church that we got married in.
Uh-huh. So it's in your blood, this French
connection, huh?
It really is. I was very fortunate when I was a young kid to, we lived, growing up in the south of England, my parents would take us down for long weekends, take us down for our vacations, and we'd travel around Normandy, Brittany, never really going too much further than that. But we just had such an amazing experience as kids growing up. With the French culture, it was phenomenal, and I was exposed to food that I'd never seen before, and that was really where my interest grew, because it was so much more exciting than the stuff I ate when I was at home.
Bangers and mash.
Absolutely.
And you've been bum used to cook bangers and mash?
No, my parents used to work a lot when I was growing up, so I pretty much had to fend for myself.
Okay.
Did they do inns in England too?
No, not at all. Not really. Never really ate out, apart from Indian food, which is obviously... Well, was the best thing going back in England back when I was growing up there, and still is very, very good.
Was when I was too, Dave.
Well, you went for a night out.
Decades before.
Yeah, that, it's always been a very strong cuisine in England.
What town were you born in?
Hemel Hempstead, which is about 30 miles north of London.
Yeah, they used to make furniture there. My brother-in-law used to go there.
I'm not sure what they do there now. I've not been back in about 10 years.
There you go.
So you said you went to a christening?
The last time I was back, we went to the christening of my nephews. That was in London. My brother lives in London, North London.
Uh-huh. Well, did we say how you get to this Gidley Park?
We didn't. We should put it on a map for listeners. And we still have another interview segment with Michael where he talks about what he cooked for dinner. But let's take a geographical segment for just a second then, if you like. Easiest way to get to Devon by regular jet service from the United States. And one of the airlines just started service into Bristol. I can't remember who it is, but I'm sure if you put Bristol into orbitz.com, you'll be able to find out. If you fly into Manchester, it's a drive of about 4 hours. If you fly to London, London Gatwick is about a four-hour drive as well. In the case of both Manchester and London, you have the opportunity to run into a whole lot of traffic in the metropolitan areas that surround them. But it's really an easy drive until you get to the tiny town of Chagford.
Oh, boy.
And you have to hope that you make the correct right fork following the signal, and then you get onto a very narrow road.
With a very high hedgerows. You can't see anything.
Yeah, you can't see around. If the car coming uphill, you have to give way. You have to back up to where they can pass.
Everything's really covered in moss.
Yeah, it's really very, very, very exciting. This is not a place where you need to necessarily pack your suntan lotion. And as you approach, it's really curious, as you approach Gidley Park, at one point it says it's a mile and a half to go. You seem like you've been driving for another 10 minutes because you're driving rather slowly. And there's a little sign that says something like, don't give up hope. You're almost there. And then around a few more bends on this muddy road, you actually reach the house that we're going to talk about later on. This is in the county of Devon and on the fringes of a national park called the Dartmoor National Park. And we're going to go to a break, and we'll be right back on the other side.
Welcome back to On the Menu. Ann and Peter Haig with Chef Danny Mosdale, and we're having a little romp through the English countryside. Let's catch one more segment. This was an interview with Chef Michael Caines, celebrity chef Michael Caines, that we did after we had actually had his food. The other conversations were before. Chef Michael Caines at Gidley Park cooked us an absolutely splendid, splendid meal last night, and it was beautifully presented as well. I wanted Michael to mention to you that I heard your style described in something I read as elemental. I would say it's lucid in the sense that your flavors were clear, there was very little contrived. Am I on target with what you're aiming to do?
Yeah, it's a lovely way of describing it. I like to have my food. I say to my chefs, it's got to do what it says on the box. If you're having lamb with thyme infused with a little bit of rosemary, that's what you want to taste. But you don't want it so overpowering that you can't taste the ingredients itself. We put a lot of time and energy into sourcing the ingredients, so we don't want to mask that flavor. We want to nurture that flavor and let it come through.
I think that our listeners would be really interested in just a run-through of what we ate for our degustacion, our tasting menu, last evening. I have the menu here in case you forgot.
Well, I mean, it's a lifetime's work almost before me here, but I thought you'd enjoy the roasted scallops with celeriac puree with a little truffle infused within that. And then we do this soy and truffle vinaigrette. And the scallops are from the south coast. They're very fresh. they come to us that night, the same evening that they're taken from the sea, so it's amazing. And you had a little marinated tuna and scallop with lime scented through it, and then topped with cetra caviar. And we did this souse vegetable with beetroot and turnip, and then we did a little wasabi cream and a honey soy vinaigrette, slightly oriented into in its style, very clean and fresh. And then we had a tartlet of poached truffle, tartlet of poached quail eggs with a confit of onion, smoked bacon, and again black truffle. We're using truffle because, you know, we have it in season now, and it's wonderful. And wild mushrooms were there as well, and we did this little light quail jus. Fantastic. That's perhaps one of my signature dishes. The milfoy foie gras with the apple and turnip and the boudin noir. The sherry vinegar sauce is a beautiful dish, and it's one that I've been doing for a while too. And it's perfect for this time of year, having the autumnal flavours and now the winter flavours coming through as well. Then we had a roasted sea bass with fennel puree, fennel cream sauce, and a red wine sauce, the acidity of the red wine cutting through the creaminess of the fennel cream. And then we had a John Doyle dory crushed on a bed of crushed olive potatoes with langoustines and tomato and tarragon, and a little bisque made from the heads of the langoustine. For main course, you had a Devon red ruby beef, which is the indigenous breed of the southwest. So again, local. All the fish is local. Here we have a local beef with a galette of potato, which has got a little smoked bacon and confit of onion in there, topped with some mushrooms with a Madeira sauce, and then we do this little broth of cappuccino of mushroom as well, and we have a little puree of mushroom piped around the outside of the plate. And then we have a saddle of local venison from Hatherley here near Okehampton, where we are, with braised belly pork, which is smoked and braised very slowly, with roasted black figs and chestnut puree. So you've got that sweetness contrasting to the richness of the venison itself.
We then moved on to assorted cheeses, and I was hoping you'd tell us, we tried to aim for the local cheeses as much as possible. Could you tell us a little bit about the revival of cheese making in this region?
Yes, it's a wonderful revival. In fact, actually, it's almost like a birth of cheese. I mean, of cheese production, because the cheeses that we're producing now are very similar to our continental friends across the way—the Italian cheeses and the French cheeses. And what we've managed to do is take the kind of iconicness of a cheddar and evolve it into much more subtle flavours. And we've taken the production of cheese to a new level here in the UK. And now we see 50% of our cheeses coming from the local region. And all of them is good enough to stand up to the French and Italian. And we're really seeing that. I mean, as farmers are diversifying, they're finding that the price of milk isn't really very profitable at all. So they're diversifying into cheese production and getting a premium on the product. So it's a fantastic evolution of cheese making. And it's almost like a birth of new styles and very exciting time.
Well, I mean, I thought they were totally splendid and agree wholeheartedly that they stand up very well to the European counterparts. We moved on, of course, to sweets, and I must say that I don't have a sweet tooth, but these were very, very good. I love the sorbets particularly. I wanted you to talk about this. Do the English have a particular gene that has to do with desserts?
We've got a sweet tooth, I guess, in England. We have a love affair with puddings, I think that's fair to say. The English love their puddings. Me, I use salt in the kitchen to balance the dishes, and in pastry, I use sugar so that we get the right balance between the acidity of the fruit, but not too much so it kind of clads the palate. So I love desserts. I find them an amazing challenge, and when we look at the sorbets, we use the fruits that are in season at the moment, and we balance that up beautifully, so you have a little acidity, and again, not too much sugar. You had a little prune and armagnac souffle. Again, the prunes are soaked in armagnac, and we make a wonderful souffle with them, perfect for this time of year. Then you have my orange plate, which consists of a little confit of mandarin, which we blanch several times in cold water, and then we cook, let them cook very slowly in a sugar stock syrup. Then we scoop out the middle, and then we make a parfait, fill it and freeze it. It's absolutely splendid. Had a little tartlet of mandarin and a little curd underneath, just sitting underneath of orange. With that also you had an orange mousse, which we make from the whole confit of the whole orange and then and the little Italian meringue, very light, refreshing. And that was sat up on a slice of orange, which was cooked in caramel stock syrup. And then you had a sorbet of confit orange, which is a confit orange is, it came from Bernard Loiseau, and it's very much refined from what I saw there develop. But it's a wonderful way of using, if you like, citrus fruits, where you confit them in sugar and use the whole of the fruit, and then it's amazing. We do the same with lime as well. It's beautiful. And then you had a trio of chocolate dessert. Very difficult to do trios of chocolate because getting the milk chocolate to work is very, very difficult. So I put it as a parfait with hazelnut, and we create this hazelnut parfait with a little bit of Frangelico in there, which is wonderful liqueur for hazelnut. And then we have a white chocolate ice cream, beautiful, lovely and soft. And then we have a dark chocolate mousse, which is a Robuchon style kind of mousse. He was famous for his dark chocolate. And I worked there, of course, and I saw that I've adapted the technique to just simply copy is not good enough, to take the recipe and to adapt it. We used to do a tart, but this makes a wonderful little chocolate mousse sat on a little sablé of chocolate. So that was your menu, and there were your desserts.
Well, that sure was quite a program, but I hope you all...
Well, it was quite an experience, and I mean, I'm already ready to go back another time. I just love it.
There we go. So, well, we hope you enjoyed a little bit of history and a super update on one of the great destinations, really, in the world for travel and leisure. We'll say hi to Sue, hi and bye to Sue and Michael as we leave the program. And until next week.
Bye-bye.